What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, two more Republicans come out against the Senate health care bill. Is that the fatal blow? And why our America First president has come to relish his time overseas. It's Tuesday, July 18th.
Hello.
Carl.
Michael.
Carl Hulse, we are calling you at home. It is late Monday night, and I am rudely distracting you from what I imagine is a well-earned cocktail. I apologize. So,
not a problem.
What just happened?
Well, in a surprise move, Republican Senators Mike Lee of Utah and Jerry Moran of Kansas have come out and said they won't support the new Republican health care bill, and that has pretty much put that bill on the edge of disaster. And I have to commend them. It looks like they sort of coordinated it, so neither one of them would be the person who brought the bill down.
So you're saying that they put out a statement together so as to insulate each other from being the person who defeated it.
Well, they put out tweets and statements at the same time, and Mike Lee mentioned in his tweet that he and Senator Moran had done this. So I credit them with a pretty capable rollout.
Carl, we already had two senators opposing this bill for very different reasons. Rand Paul thought that it wasn't conservative enough. Susan Collins said that the cuts to Medicaid were going to be too tough on her constituents. So a moderate and a conservative opposing it. Tell us more about Mike Lee of Utah and Jerry Moran of Kansas. Why did they come out against this?
So they're opposing an attempt to bring this particular bill, the draft of this bill, to the floor. And both of these senators are pretty much coming at it from the right. They're not saying that it doesn't do enough for Medicaid. You know, Senator Moran is saying that it doesn't repeal and replace the way that he would like to see. Senator Lee is saying it still raises premiums for middle-class Americans due to the need to cover pre-existing conditions.
And this is the second version of the Senate health care bill.
They've already tweaked it.
To not make it through.
They've done a lot to bring people on board. And Senator McConnell and the leadership was pretty happy that over the weekend, with the attention on Senator McCain's illness, that no one else came out and said, I'm not going to vote for this. But these two senators did tonight, and they really created an uproar.
So you mentioned Senator John McCain. This all began earlier today with the strong sense that John McCain alone was going to be holding up this bill because of a medical problem he had that kept him out of Washington. Do you think that the delay that John McCain's absence triggered might have led us to this point?
Yeah, in some ways I do, because you know, people wanted to sit down, evaluate the bill, and I think these two senators sat down and said, well, we shouldn't let this just drift right now and you know, wait for John McCain to come back in a week or 2 weeks. We're going to say right now that we're against it. You know, it's a bit of a shock.
Carl, what's interesting is I don't feel like either of these senators were on anyone's list of lawmakers to watch, people who could sink this thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Certainly, Jerry Moran, a very quiet senator, he ran the senatorial campaign committee a few years ago when the Republicans focused on health care repeal. But the kind of guy who's really part of the establishment and the leadership, Mike Lee is a different story, conservative, willing to go it alone. But folks were looking more towards the senators who are worried about Medicaid cuts to their state.
What do you think ultimately kill this bill, Carl? Is it, not to be too simple, but is it too mean or not mean enough or something in the middle?
I think it's just impossible with the narrow margin that Mitch McConnell has to calibrate between the two sides. You have Rand Paul, who wants to totally scrap Obamacare and start over. And in some respects, Mike Lee and Jerry Moran have joined him. You have other people on the other side saying, you know, we can't take these benefits away. The residents of our states have begun to depend on them. Our governors like them. We have to run for election. I just think, you know, some things defy solution in Washington, which is always kind of hard for members in the media to accept. It's like there's no easy solution there. And I think that you're seeing that now. There's just not a easy compromise here.
Does this now mean that the Affordable Care Act stays in place for the foreseeable future?
I think whatever happens, I think there needs to be some changes made to the Affordable Care Act to stabilize the insurance markets. And that's where you're seeing the clamor from a few Republicans and many Democrats saying, okay, you've failed twice now. Mm-hmm. We need to sit down, work out a way to fix the Obamacare law so we can proceed here. You know, is there going to be an immediate rush to compromise? I don't think so, but I think more and more people are looking in that direction.
But what you're saying seems to assume tinkering and tweaking, but not repeal.
I mean, the idea of total repeal seems very distant right now.
Carl, how are Democrats in the Senate responding to the news on Monday night that it looks like the Republican plan to repeal and replace has collapsed?
Well, there's definitely some glee out there, and you hear a lot of celebrating. But it's also the idea of like, okay, you tried, you failed. Let's get together and try and work something out. But I think Democrats, you know, privately, they also see this as a great political victory for them. They've been saying, don't touch this. You know, they also know they can bang on Republicans for not fulfilling their repeal promise.
And let's talk about Republicans for a minute. They campaigned, as we've talked about, on repealing and replacing Obamacare for years, and they now control the White House, they control the House of Representatives and the Senate, and this bill appears to be more or less dead. So how big a deal is that politically?
I think it's a really big deal. I think that Republicans look at this and say, how are we going to go and run again in 2 years when it's going to be a very tough environment and say, you know, we're the governing party and we couldn't do the basic thing that we told you we were going to do. And a failure here is going to have political costs. And I think it's probably going to take a while to sink in, you know, with some of their constituents. But I do think at the end of the day, this is a big political failure that they will pay a price for. I've talked to Republican strategists who've said they still think that the repercussions for failing to repeal Obamacare for their members are bigger than the repercussions they would face for repealing it and cutting benefits for people. That's what they think.
That's fascinating. So finally, Carl, are you surprised that the bill failed?
Not particularly. My experience in Washington is that, you know, it's one thing to not give people benefits. It's a totally different thing to take something away from people. You immediately create a constituency to keep that benefit alive. I think that's what Republicans ran into here. You can't take things away from people that, you know, over 7 years they've come to rely on. You know, maybe in the first year they could have done this or even the second year, but it got too intertwined in the healthcare system and people, you know, people like it.
Carl, thank you. It's late. I appreciate it.
Michael, good luck. Hope you don't have to stay up too late.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Around 11 p.m. Monday night, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell conceded that, quote, the effort to repeal and immediately replace the failure of Obamacare will not be successful. But he said he would move to pass a measure that would repeal the Affordable Care Act with a 2-year delay while Republicans came up with a replacement that could leave millions of people without insurance and the insurance markets in turmoil. President Trump also called for that strategy in a tweet Monday night. Republicans, he said,
should just repeal failing Obamacare now and work on a new health plan that would start from a clean slate. Dems, he added, will join in. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
I'm going to mess up the lyrics, but the tune is...
Maggie was in the high school choir.
I'm beginning to see the light. Like that.
That's it for The Daily. And I'm Michael Arvaro. See you tomorrow.
And scene.
Okay, so we're going to jump in. Maggie Haberman, what were the circumstances under which President Trump went to France last week? Why did he go at all?
So he was invited by the president of France, with whom he had had a pretty tense relationship. If you recall, they had those bizarre handshakes, you know, that were the handshakes heard around the world.
The president's not going to take that line down. He's going to pull him into the strong man handshake.
It was like the firmest handshake in the history of diplomacy.
It was, and like the one with the most back and forth.
No, they have a total tug of war, but this one lasts an epic.
I'm still feeling the
pain. It was feral, I think was the word I used in a descriptive capacity about it the other day. The president of France was trying to establish with the U.S. president that he couldn't be intimidated.
Macron telling a French newspaper it was, quote, a moment of truth. One must show that we will not make little concessions, even symbolic ones.
So they were having a phone call about unrelated issues. I think it was about Syria. And in the middle of it, President Macron invited President Trump to France for the Bastille Day celebrations. And he told him that this was the 100th anniversary of the U.S. joining World War I. And, you know, the U.S. president loves a good parade. And he loves a good military parade. As people may or may not know, he had wanted to military up his own inaugural parade with tanks and jets and was told he couldn't do it. So he agreed to go, and it was a little jarring for his team because they were just planning on coming back from the G20, which was a several days long trip to Europe. So President Trump came back on a Saturday, and then he left again on a Wednesday.
Is it unusual for a president to make a trip for something like that, something that's essentially just witnessing a single public event with so little notice and with no real diplomatic goals in mind?
It is. And look, I mean, I think that they would point to some short-term diplomatic goals that they were able to, you know, if not achieve, work toward. Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, was along.
What does that mean exactly?
I think they were talking about counterterrorism. I think they were talking about Syria. I think they tried to turn this into a working trip as much as possible. But to your point, he was basically on the ground for about 36 hours. That's not a whole lot of time to do. And not even, actually. I think maybe 30. What has been really striking about this president, who has traveled pretty little within the U.S., he really loves the foreign travel in ways that have been surprising.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, because I remember when he went on his first international trip and you said that he was dreading it, and that he didn't like to leave the familiar comforts of home, even though that home had moved to Washington.
It was a 9-day trip. He generally likes to keep them around 5 days, and so the subsequent trips were obviously shorter. But I think that he loved the welcome mat that was rolled out when he went to Saudi Arabia.
President coming out of his motorcade, walking around, greeting King Salman right at the edge of the red carpet.
And he definitely liked the treatment that he got in Poland.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And I think that Macron has learned from his own earlier mistakes and mistakes of others, which is that you're not really going to make a dent in Donald Trump's thinking. And if that's your goal, you're not going to get there by being in a shouting match with him or a wrestling handshake match with him. You're going to actually have to sort of schmooze him because that's what he responds to. And he responds to shows of deference and respect. And that's what this trip turned into.
We have found also allies and friends who have come to our rescue. The United States of America is in that category, and that is why nothing will ever separate us. The presence today at my side of the President of the United States and his wife is a sign of that friendship.
So it sounds like the president's appetite for foreign travel has changed, and the eagerness of foreign leaders to have him has changed.
I think that's right. I think that they've realized how to achieve a goal better with him. I also think you can't discount the degree to which a lot of this is escapism. Remember, he left a few days after our paper first reported that his son, Don Jr., had hosted this meeting at Trump Tower with a Russian lawyer who was promising dirt on Hillary Clinton. I think that he was pretty eager to leave that behind.
Hmm. Tell me more about that.
I'm trying to think the best way to describe this. So Trump is a deals guy, which we know. It's all about the transaction. He's the most transactional person I've ever met and certainly the most transactional politician I've ever covered. And that's saying something because we've covered a lot of politicians.
Involved in a lot of transactions.
Involved in a lot of transactions. That's a deep thought. And he likes selling. Every time I've interviewed him, it has generally been him trying to sell me in some way. And I think that he has recognized that the sales job is a lot harder in the U.S. right now than it is overseas. And so I think that some of this for him is finding new territories to conquer. Think of France as a really nice caucus state that he's going to try to win over.
What is he selling abroad exactly, though?
Himself. You know, the respectability of him as the president, which I think he has been, you know, met with questions certainly by half the country in the United States. I mean, his critics, many of them describe him as an illegitimate president. And, you know, whether people agree with that or not, and I think it's, you know, he certainly was legitimately elected. But I think that he finds himself treated as if he is on par with others when he is overseas with these foreign leaders. And it gives a level of respect that Trump really craves.
Maggie Haberman, thank you very much and welcome home.
Thank you.
I never do.
Oh, in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the light. I never went in for afterglow.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.
The dark, then you came and caused a spark.